3. The marriage party made its way toward Tyree Bubble's dock, shuffling along to beating tambourines. Youngsters, gaily decked in rice flowers and pinion garlands, danced alongside the newlyweds. Although many of the children wore masks or makeup to disguise minor birth defects, they seemed light of spirit. They were the only ones. Some adults tried their best, chanting and shouting at all the right places, especially several dozen refugees, Tyree's allocated share of threadbare escapees from the ruins of Sishin and Sadul settlements, who cheered with the fervid eagerness of people desperately trying for acceptance in their new home rather than mere sufferance. As for other guests from unaffected domes, most appeared to have come only for free food. These now crowded near the dock, eager to depart as soon as the nuptial sub was on its way. Not that Jonah could blame them. Most people preferred staying close to home ever since the thump started going all crazy, setting off a chain of tragedies, tearing at the old, placid ways. And today's thump is already overdue, he thought. In fact, there hadn't been a ground-shaking comet strike in close to a month. Such a gap would have been unnerving just a year or two ago. Now, given how awful some recent impacts had been, any respite was welcome. A time of chaos. Few see good omens, even in a new marriage. Jonah glanced at his bride, come to collect him from Losan Bubble, all the way at the far northern outlet of Cleopatra Canyon. Taller than average, with a clear complexion and strong carriage, she had good hips and only a slight mutant modeling on the back of her scalp, where the hair grew in a wild, discolored corkscrew. An easily overlooked defect, like Jonah's lack of toe webbing, or the way he would sneeze or yawn uncontrollably whenever the air pressure changed too fast. No one jettisoned a child over such inconsequentials. Though you can be exiled forever from all you ever knew if you're born with the genetic defect of maleness. Jonah could not help scanning the workshops and dorms, the pinions and paddies of Tyree, wondering if he would see this place, his birth bubble, ever again. Perhaps, if the grandmothers of Lausanne trusted him with errands, or next time Tyree hosted a festival, if his new wife chose to take him along. He had barely met Petri Smoth before this day, having spoken just a few words with her over the years, at various craft and seed fairs hosted by some of the largest domes. During last year's festival, held in ill-fated Aldrin Bubble, she had asked him a few pointed questions about some tinkered gimmicks he had on display. In fact, now that he looked back on it, her tone and expression must have been evaluating, weighing his answers with this possible outcome in mind. It just never occurred to Jonah at the time that he was impressing a girl enough to choose him as a mate. I thought she was interested in my improved ballast transfer valve. And maybe, in a way, she was. Or, at least, in Jonah's mechanical abilities. Panalina had suggested that explanation yesterday, while helping Jonah prepare his dowry, an old cargo truck that he had purchased with his prize winnings for claiming the Dead Sea Serpent, a long-discarded submersible freighter that he had spent the last year reconditioning. A hopeless wreck, some called it. But no longer. Well, it's functional, I'll give you that. The master mechanic of Tyree Bubble had decreed last night, after going over the vessel from stem to stern, checking everything from hand-wound anchor tethers and stone keel weights to the bench where several pairs of burly men might labor at a long crank, turning a propeller to drive the boat forward. She thumped extra storage bubbles, turning stopcocks to sniff at the hissing, pressurized air. Then Panalina tested levers that would let seawater into those tanks if need be, keeping the sub weighed down on the bottom, safe from falling into the deadly sky. It'll do, she finally decreed, to Jonah's relief. This could help him begin married life on a good note. Not every boy got to present his new bride with a whole submarine. Jonah had acquired the old relic months before people realized just how valuable each truck might be, even junkers like this one, for rescue and escape as a chain of calamities disrupted the canyon settlements. His repairs hadn't been completed in time to help evacuate more families from cracked and doomed Sashin or Sadul bubbles, and he felt bad about that. Still, with Panalina's ruling of seaworthiness, this vehicle would help make Petri Smoth a woman of substance in the hierarchy at Lausanne and prove Jonah a real asset to his wife. Only, what happens when so many bubbles fail that the others can't take refugees anymore? Already there was talk of sealing Tyree against outsiders, even evacuees, and concentrating on total self-reliance. Some spoke of arming the colony's subs for war. These older hull bubbles were thicker and heavier, Panalina commented, patting the nearest bulkhead, the first of three ancient, translucent spheres that had been fused together into a short chain like a trio of pearls on a string. They fell out of favor maybe 4 or 5 mother generations ago. You'll need to pay 6 big fellows in order to crank a full load of trade goods. That won't leave you much profit on cargo. Good old Panalina, always talking as if everything would soon be normal again, as if the barter network was likely to ever be the same. With streaks of gray in her hair, the artificer claimed to be 60 years old, but was certainly younger. The grandmothers let her get away with the fib and what would normally be criminal neglect, leaving her womb fallow most of the time, with only 2 still living heirs, and both of those boys. Still, Panalina looked around and thumped the hull one last time, he's a sturdy little boat. You know, there was talk among the mothers about refusing to let you take him away from Tyree. The Smoths had to promise 0.5 ton of crushed grapes in return, and to take in one of the Sadul families. Still, I think it's you they mostly want. Jonah had puzzled over that cryptic remark after Panalina left. Then all during the Bruce-willed bachelor party, suffering crude jokes and ribbing from the married men, and later during a fretful sleep shift as he tossed and turned with pre-wedding jitters. During the ceremony itself, Mother had been gracious and warm, not her typical mean, but a side of her that Jonah felt he would surely miss. Though he knew that an underlying source of her cheerfulness was simple, one less male mouth to feed. It had made Jonah reflect, even during the wrist-binding part of the ceremony, on something old scholar Wu said recently. The balance of the sexes may change if it really comes down to war. Breeders could start to seem less valuable than fighters. In the dock lock, Jonah found that his little truck had been decked with flowers, and all 3 of the spheres gleamed where they had been polished above the waterline. The gesture warmed Jonah's heart. There was even a freshly painted name arcing just above the propeller. Bird of Tyree. Well, Mother had always loved stories about those prehistoric creatures of old Earth who flew through a sky that was immeasurably vast and sweet. I thought you were going to name it after me, Petri commented in a low voice, without breaking her gracious smile. I shall do that, Lady Love, just after we dock in Lausanne. Well, perhaps not just after, she commented, and Jonah's right buttock took a sharp-nailed pinch. He managed not to jump or visibly react, but clearly his new wife did not intend wasting time once they were home. Home. He would have to redefine the word in his mind. Still, as Jonah checked the final loading of luggage, gifts, and passengers, he glanced at the fantail one last time, picturing there a name that he really wanted to give the little vessel. Renewed Hope. 4. They were underway, having traveled more than 0.5 of the distance to Lausanne Bubble, when a thump struck at the wrong time, at the worst possible time, shaking the little sub-truck like a rattle. The blow came hard and late, so late that everyone at the wedding had simply written off any chance of one today. Folks assumed that at least another work and sleep cycle would pass without a comet fall. Already, this was the longest gap in memory. Perhaps, some murmured, the age of thumps had come to an end, as prophesied long ago. After the disaster that befell Aldrin and Bezo 2 months ago, it was a wish now shared by all. Up until that very moment, the nuptial voyage had been placid, enjoyable, even for tense newlyweds. Jonah was at the tiller up front, gazing ahead through a patch of hull bubble that had been polished on both sides, making it clear enough to see through, hoping that he looked like a stalwart, fierce-eyed seaman. He gripped the rudder ropes that steered Bird of Tyree, though the sub's propeller lay still and powerless. For this voyage, the old truck was being hauled as a trailer, behind a larger, sleeker, and more modern Losinite sub, where a team of 12 burly men sweated and tugged in perfect rhythm, turning their drive shaft crank. Petrie stood beside her new husband, while passengers chattered in the second compartment behind them. As bubble colonies drifted past, she gestured at each of the gleaming domes and spoke of womanly matters, like the politics of trade and diplomacy, or the personalities and traditions of each settlement, which goods and food items they excelled at producing or needed, their rates of mutation and successful child raising, or how well each habitat was managing its genetic diversity. And her tone changed a bit at that point, as if suddenly aware how the topic bore upon them both. For this marriage match had been judged by the Losan mothers on that basis above all others. "Of course I had final say, the final choice," she told Jonah, and it warmed him that Petrie felt a need to explain. "Anyway, there is a project I've been working on," she continued in a lower voice, "with a few others in Losan and Landis bubbles, younger folks mostly. And we can use a good mechanic like you." "Like me? So I was chosen for that reason?" Jonah felt put off and tensed a bit when Petrie put an arm around his waist, but she leaned up and whispered in his ear, "I think you'll like what we're up to. It's something just right for a rascal." The word surprised him, and he almost turned to stare. But her arm was tight, and Petrie's breath was still in his ear. So Jonah chose to keep his features steady, unmoved. Perhaps sensing his stiff reaction, Petrie let go. She slid around to face him with her back resting against the transparent patch, leaning against the window. "Clever girl," he thought. It was the direction he had to look in order to watch the Pride of Losan's rudder up ahead, matching his tiller to that of the larger sub. Now he could not avert his eyes from her, using boyish reticence as an excuse. Petrie's oval face was a bit wide, as were her eyes. The classic Losan chin cleft was barely noticeable, though her mutant patch, the whorl of wild hair, was visible as a reflection behind her on the bubble's curved inner surface. Her wedding garment, sleek and form-fitting, revealed enough to prove her fitness to bear and nurse, plus a little more. And Jonah wondered, when am I supposed to let the sight of her affect me, arouse me? Too soon, and he might seem brutish, in need of tight reins. Too late or too little, and his bride might feel insulted. And fretting over it will make me an impotent fool. Deliberately, Jonah calmed himself, allowing some pleasure to creep in at the sight of her. A seed of anticipation grew, as he knew she wanted. "What project are you talking about? Something involving trucks?" he offered a guess. "Something the mothers may not care for? Something suited to a... He glanced over his shoulder, past the open hatch leading to the middle bubble, containing a jumble of cargo, wedding gifts and Jonah's hope chest, plus luggage for Losan dignitaries who rode in comfort aboard the bigger submersible ahead. Here, a dozen lower caste passengers sat or lay atop the stacks and piles, some of Petrie's younger cousins, plus a family of evacuees from doomed Sadul Dome, sent to relieve Tyree's overcrowded refugee encampment as part of the complex marriage deal. Perhaps it would be best to hold off this conversation until a time and place with fewer ears around, to pick up stray sonic reflections. Perhaps delaying it for wife and husband pillow talk, the one and only kind of privacy that could be relied upon in the colonies. He looked forward again, raising one eyebrow, and Petrie clearly got his meaning, Still, in a lower voice, she finished Jonah's sentence.
To a rascal, yes. In fact, your reputation as a young fellow always coming up with bothersome questions helped me bargain well for you. Did you intend it that way, I wonder? For you to wind up only sought by one like me who would value such attributes? If so, clever boy.
Jonah decided to keep silent, letting Petri give him credit for cunning he never had. After a moment, she shrugged with a smile, then continued in a voice that was nearly inaudible.
But in fact, our small bunch of conspirators and connivers were inspired by yet another rascal. The one we have foremost in our minds was a fellow named Melville.
Jonah had been about to ask about the mysterious we, but mention of that particular name stopped him short. He blinked hard, 2, 3 times, striving not to flinch or otherwise react. It took him several tries to speak, barely mouthing the words.
You're talking about Theodora Canyon?
A place of legend, and Petri's eyes now conveyed many things. Approval of his quickness overlain upon an evident grimness of purpose, a willingness, even eagerness, to take risks and adapt in chaotic times, finding a path forward, even if it meant following a folktale. All of that was apparent in Petri's visage, though clearly Jonah was expected to say more.
I've heard, one hears rumors, that there was a map to what Melville found. Another canyon filled with gift of Venus bubbles like those the founders discovered here in Cleopatra Canyon. But the mothers forbade any discussion or return voyages, and
Jonah slowed down when he realized he was babbling.
And so, after Melville fled his punishment, they hid the map away. I've been promised a copy, Petri confided, evidently weighing his reaction, once we're ready to set out.
Jonah couldn't help himself. He turned around again to check the next compartment where several smaller children were chasing one another up and down the luggage piles, making a ruckus and almost tipping over a crate of Panalina's smithy tools, consigned for transshipment to Golank's dome. Beyond, through a second hatchway to the final chamber where sweating rowers would normally sit, lay stacked bags of exported Tyree rice. The refugee family and several of Petri's subadult cousins lounged back there, talking idly, keeping apart from the raucous children. Jonah looked back at his bride, still keeping his voice low.
You're kidding. So there truly was a boy named Melville who stole a sub and...
For a month and a week and a day and an hour, Petri finished for him, then returned with tales of a far-off canyon filled with gleaming bubbles of all sizes, a vast foam of hollow volcanic globes left over from this world's creation, never touched by human hands. Bubbles just as raw and virginal as our ancestors found when they first arrived down here beneath a newborn ocean, seeking refuge far below the poisoned sky.
Much of what she said was from the Founder's Catechism, retaining its rhythm and flowery tone. Clearly it amused Petri to quote modified scripture while speaking admiringly of an infamous rebel. Jonah could tell as much from her wry expression. But poetry, and especially irony, had always escaped Jonah, and she might as well get used to that husbandly lack right now.
So, this is about finding new homes? Perhaps. If things keep getting worse here in Cleo Abyss, shouldn't we have options? Oh, we're selling it as an expedition to harvest fresh bubbles, all the sizes that have grown scarce hereabouts, useful for helmets and cooking and chemistry. But we'll also check out any big ones. Maybe they're holding up better in Theodora than they are here. Because, at the rate things are going...
Petri shook her head, and looking downward, her expression leaked just a bit, losing some of its tough, determined veneer, giving way to plainly visible worry.
She knows things. Information that the mothers won't tell mere men, and she's afraid.
Strangely, that moment of vulnerability touched Jonah's heart, thawing a patch that he had never realized was chill. For the first time, he felt drawn, compelled to reach out, not sexually, but to comfort, to hold. That was when the thump struck, harder than Jonah would have believed possible. Concussion slammed the little submarine over halfway onto its port side and set the ancient bubble hull ringing. Petri hurtled into him, tearing the rudder straps from his hands as they tumbled together backward, caroming off the open hatch between compartments, then rolling forward again as Bird of Tyree heaved. With the sliver of his brain that still functioned, Jonah wondered if there had been a collision, but the Losanite ship was bobbing and rocking some distance ahead, still tethered to the bird, and nothing else was closer than a bubble habitat at least 200 meters away. Jonah caught sight of all this while landing against the window patch up front, with Petri squished between. This time, as the bird lurched again, he managed to grab a stanchion and hold on, while gripping her waist with his other arm. Petri's breath came in wheezing gasps, and now there was no attempt to mask her terror.
What? What was...
Jonah swallowed, bracing himself against another rocking sway that almost tore her from his grasp.
A thump! Do you hear the low tone? But they're never this late!
He didn't have breath to add, I've never felt one outside a dome before. No one ventures into water during late morning when comets always used to fall. And now Jonah knew why. His ears rang and hurt like crazy. All this time he had been counting. Thump vibrations came in sequence. One tone passed through rock by compression, arriving many seconds before the slower transverse waves. He had once even read one of Scholar Wu's books about that with partial understanding, and he recalled what the old teacher said, that you could tell from the difference in tremor arrivals how far away the impact was from Cleopatra Canyon. 21, 22, 23. Jonah hoped to reach 62 seconds, the normal separation for generation after generation of grandmothers. 24, 20. The transverse tone, higher pitched and much louder than ever, set the forward bubble of the bird ringing like a bell, even as the tooth-jarring sways diminished, allowing Jonah and Petri to grab separate straps and find their feet. Less than half the usual distance. That comet almost hit us. He struggled with a numb brain. Maybe just a couple of thousand kilometers away.
The children!
Petri cried and cast herself stumbling aft toward the middle compartment. Jonah followed, but just two steps in order to verify no seals were broken. No hatches had to be closed and dogged. Not yet. And the crying kids back there looked shaken, not badly hurt. So, okay, trust Petri to take care of things back there. As he plunged back to the tiller harness. Soon, Jonah was tugging at bulky cables, struggling to make the rudder obedient, fighting surges while catching brief glimpses of a tumult outside. Ahead, 40 or 50 meters, the Pride of Lausanne's propeller churned a roiling cauldron of water. The men inside must be cranking with all their might. Backward, Jonah realized with dismay. Their motion in reverse might bring the Pride's prop in contact with the towline. Why are they hauling us backward? One clue. The tether remained taut and straight, despite the rower's efforts. And, with a horrified realization, Jonah realized why. The bigger sub tilted upward, almost halfway to vertical with its nose aimed high. They've lost their main ballast. Great slugs of stone and raw metal normally weighed a sub down, lashed along the keel. They must have torn loose amid the chaos of the thump, nearly all of them. But how? Certainly bad luck and lousy maintenance, or a hard collision with the ocean bottom. For whatever reason, the Pride of Lausanne was straining upward, climbing toward the sky. Already, Jonah could see one of the bubble habitats from an angle no canyonite ever wanted. Looking down upon the curved dome from above, its forest of pinyon vines glowing from within. Cursing his own slowness of mind, Jonah let go of the rudder cables and half stumbled toward the hatch at the rear of the control chamber, shouting for Petri. There was a job to do, more vital than any other. Their very lives might depend on it. 5. When I give the word, open valve number 1, just a quarter turn. It wasn't a demure tone to use toward a woman, but he saw no sign of wrath or resentment as his new wife nodded. A quarter turn. Yes, Jonah. Clamping his legs around one of the ballast jars, he started pushing rhythmically on his new and improved model air pump. Okay. Now! As soon as Petri twisted the valve, they heard water spew into the ballast chamber, helping Jonah push the air out for storage at pressure in a neighboring bottle. It would be simpler and less work to just let the air spill outside, but he couldn't bring himself to do that. There might be further uses for the stuff. When Bird started tilting sideways, he shifted their efforts to a bottle next to the starboard viewing patch, another bit of the old hull that had been polished for seeing. Farther aft, in the third compartment, he could hear some of the passengers struggling with bags of rice, clearing the propeller crank for possible use. In fact, Jonah had ordered it done mostly to give them a distraction, something to do. "We should be getting heavier," he told Petri, as they shifted back and forth, left to right, then left again, letting water into storage bubbles and storing displaced air. As expected, this had an effect on the sub's pitch, raising the nose as it dragged on the tether cable, which, in turn, linked them to the crippled Pride of Lausanne. The crew of that hapless vessel had given up cranking to propel their ship backward. Everything depended on Jonah and Petri now. If they could make Bird heavy enough, quickly enough, both vessels might be prevented from sinking into the sky. "And we'll be heroes," Jonah pondered at one point while his arms throbbed with pain. This could be a great start to his life and reputation in Lausanne Bubble. That is, if it worked. Jonah ached to go and check the little sub's instruments, but there was no time. Not even when he drafted the father of the Sadul refugee family to pump alongside him. Gradually, all the tanks were filling, making the Bird heavier, dragging at the runaway Pride of Lausanne. And indeed, yes, he saw a welcome sight. One of the big habitat domes. Perhaps the very one they had been passing when the thump struck. Jonah shared a grin with Petri, seeing in her eyes a glimmer of earned respect. "Perhaps I'll need to rest a bit before our wedding night." Though funny, it didn't feel as if fatigue would be a problem. Weighed down by almost full ballast tanks, Birds slid almost along the great curved flank of the habitat. Jonah signaled Zirish to ease off pumping and for Petri to close her valve. He didn't want to hit the sea bottom too hard. As they descended, Petri identified the nearby colony as Leininger Dome. It was hard to see much through both sweat-stung eyes and the barely polished window patch, but Jonah could soon tell that a crowd of citizens had come to press their faces against the inner side of the great transparent bubble wall, staring up and out toward the descending subs. As Bird drifted backward, it appeared that the landing would be pretty fast. Jonah shouted for all the passengers to brace themselves for a rough impact, one that should come any second as they drew even with the Leininger onlookers, a bump into bottom mud that didn't come. Something was wrong. Instinct told him before reason could, when Jonah's ears popped and he gave vent to a violent sneeze. Oh no. Petri and Jonah stared at the Leiningerites, who stared back in resigned dismay as the Bird dropped below their ground level and kept dropping. Or rather, Leininger Bubble kept ascending, faster and faster, tugged by the deadly buoyancy of all that air inside, its anchor roots torn loose by that last violent thump. Following the path and fate of Bezo Colony, without the warning that it allowed partial evacuation of Sishin and Sadul. With a shout of self-loathing, Jonah rushed to perform a task that he should have done already, check instruments. The pressure gauge wouldn't be much use in an absolute sense, but relative values could at least tell if they were falling. Not just relative to the doomed habitat, but drifting back toward the safe bottom muck, or else... "Rising," he told Petri in a low voice, as she sidled alongside and rested her head against his shoulder. He slid his arm around her waist, as if they had been married forever. Or, at least, most of what remained of their short lives. "Is there anything else we can do?" she asked. "Not much," he shrugged. "Finish flooding the tanks, I suppose, but they're already almost full and the weight isn't enough. That is just too strong." And he pointed out the forward viewing patch at the Pride of Lausanne, its five large, air-filled compartments buoyant enough to overcome any resistance by this little truck. "But
Can't they do what we've done? Fill their own balls, ballast tanks. Sorry, my lady, they don't have any big ones. Just a few little bottles for adjusting trim.
Jonah kept his voice even and matter-of-fact, the way a vessel captain should, even though his stomach churned with dread, explaining how external keep weights saved interior cargo space. Also, newer craft used bubbles with slimmer walls. You didn't want to penetrate them with too many inlets, valves, and such.
And no one else has your new pump, Petrie added, and her approving tone meant more to Jonah in these final minutes than he ever would have expected. Of course, he mused.
Yes, you've thought of something?
Well, if we could somehow cut the tether cable, we'd sink back to safety.
Then Petrie frowned.
But we're the only chance they have on the Pride of Lassan.
Without our weight, they would shoot skyward like a seed pip from a lorgo fruit.
Anyway, it's up to them to decide, Jonah explained. The tether release is at their end, not ours.
Sorry, it's a design flaw that I'll fix as soon as I get a chance, right after repainting your name on the stern.
See that you do, she commanded.
Then, after a brief pause,
do you think they might release us when they realize both ships are doomed?
Jonah shrugged. There was no telling what people would do when faced with such an end. He vowed to stand watch, though, just in case. He sneezed hard, twice. Pressure effects were starting to tell on him.
Should we inform the others?
He asked Petrie, with a nod back toward Bird's other two compartments, where the crying had settled down to low whimpers from a couple of younger kids. She shook her head.
It will be quick, yes?
Jonah considered lying and dismissed the idea.
It depends.
As we rise, the water pressure outside falls, so if air pressure inside remains high, that could lead to a blowout, cracking one of our shells, letting the sea rush in awfully fast. So fast, we'll be knocked out before we can drown. Of course, that's the least gruesome end.
What a cheerful lad, she commented. Go on.
Let's say the hull compartments hold. This is a tough old bird, he patted the nearest curved flank. We can help protect against blowout by venting compartment air, trying to keep pace with falling pressure outside. In that case, we'll suffer one kind or another kind of pressure change disease. The most common is the bends. That's when gas that's dissolved in our blood suddenly pops into tiny bubbles that fill your veins and arteries. I hear it's a painful way to die. Whether because of his mutation or purely in his mind, Jonah felt a return of the scratchy throat and burning eyes. He turned his head barely in time to sneeze away from the window in Petrie. She was looking behind them into the next compartment. If death is unavoidable, but we can pick our way to die, then I say let's choose. At that moment, Jonah tensed at a sudden jarring sensation, a snap that rattled the viewing patch in front of him. Something was happening above and ahead. Without light from the Cleopatra domes, darkness was near total outside, broken only by some algae glow bulbs placed along the flank of the Pride of Lausanne. Letting go of Petrie, he went to all the bulbs inside the bird's forward compartment and covered them, then hurried back to press his face against the viewing patch.
What is it? Petrie asked. What's going on?
I think... Jonah made out a queer, sinuous rippling in the blackness between the two submarines. He jumped as something struck the window. With pounding heart, he saw and heard a snake-like thing slither across the clear zone of bubble before falling aside. And beyond, starting from just 20 meters away, the row of tiny glow spots now shot upward like legendary rockets, quickly diminishing, then fading from view.
The tether, he announced in a matter-of-fact voice.
They let go? Let us go? A blend of hope and awe in her voice.
Made sense, he answered.
They were goners anyway.
And now they will be the heroes when all is told. Songs will be sung about their choice back home. That is, assuming there still is a home. We have no idea if Leininger Dome was the only victim this time.
He stared at the pressure gauge. After a long pause when it refused to budge, the needle finally began to move, opposite to its former direction of change.
We're descending, he decreed with a sigh.
In fact, we'd better adjust to keep from falling too fast. It wouldn't do to reach safety down there, only to crack open from the impact. Jonah put the Sadoolite dad, Zirish, to work, pumping in the opposite direction, less frantically than before, but harder work, using compressed air to push out and overboard some water from the ballast tanks, while Petri, now experienced, handled the valves. After supervising for a few minutes, he went back to the viewing port and peered outside. I must keep a sharp lookout for the lights of Cleo Canyon. We may have drifted laterally, and I can adjust better while we're falling than later at the bottom. He used the rudder and stubby elevation planes to turn the little sub, explaining to Petri how it was done. She might have to steer if Jonah's strength was needed on the propeller crank. A low, concussive report caused the chamber to rattle and groan. Not as bad as the horrid thump had been, but closer, coming from somewhere above. Jonah shared eye contact with Petri, a sad recognition of something inevitable. The end of a gallant ship, pride of Losan. Two more muffled booms followed, rather fainter than another. They must have closed their inner hatches. Each compartment is failing separately. But something felt wrong about that. The third concussion especially had felt deep-throated, lasting longer than reasonable. Amid another bout of sneezing, Jonah pressed close against the view patch once again in order to peer about, first toward the bottom, then upward. Clearly, this day had to be the last straw. It rang a death knell for the old complacent ways of doing things. Leininger had been a big, important colony, and perhaps not today's only major victim. If thumps were going unpredictable and lethal, then Cleopatra might have to be abandoned. Jonah knew very little about the plan concocted by Petri's mysterious cabal of young women and men, though he was glad to have been chosen to help, to follow a rascal's legend in search of new homes. In fact, two things were abundantly clear. Expeditions must get underway just as soon as we get back, and there should be more than just one following Melville's clues. Subs must be sent in many directions. If Venus created other realms filled with hollow volcanic globes that can be seeded with earthly life, then we must find them. A second fact had also emerged, made evident during the last hour or so. Jonah turned to glance back at a person he had barely known until just a day ago. It appears that I married really well. Although the chamber was very dim, Petri glanced up from her task and noticed him looking at her. She smiled, an expression of respect and dawning equality that seemed just as pleased as he now felt. Jonah smiled back, then unleashed another great sneeze, at which she chirped a short laugh and shook her head in fake mocking ruefulness. Grinning, he turned back to the window, gazed upward, then shouted, "Grab something! Brace yourselves!" That was all he had time or breath to cry while yanking on the tiller cables and shoving his knee hard against the elevator control plane. Bird heeled over to starboard, both rolling and struggling to yaw turn. Harsh cries of surprise and alarm erupted from the back compartments as crates and luggage toppled. He heard Petri shout, "Stay where you are!" at the panicky Zirish, who whimpered in terror. Jonah caught a glimpse of them, reflected in the view patch as they clutched one of the air storage bottles to keep from tumbling across the deck onto the right side bulkhead. "Come on, old boy," he urged the little sub, and wished he had six strong men cranking at the stern end, driving the propeller to accelerate Bird of Tyree forward. If there had been, Jonah might, just barely, have guided the sub clear of peril tumbling from above, debris from a catastrophe, only a small fraction of it glittering in the darkness. Hard chunks of something rattled against the hull. He glimpsed an object, thin and metallic, perhaps a torn piece of pipe, carom off the view patch with a bang, plowing several nasty scars before it fell away. Jonah half expected the transparent zone to start spalling and cracking at any second. That didn't happen, but now debris was coming down in a positive rain, clattering along the whole length of his vessel, testing the sturdy old shells with every strike. Desperate, he hauled even harder, steering Bird away from what seemed the worst of it, toward a zone that glittered a bit less. More cries erupted from the back two chambers. I should have sealed the hatches, he thought. But then, what good would that do for anyone, honestly? Having drifted laterally from Cleo Canyon, any surviving chambers would be helpless, unable to maneuver, never to be found or rescued before the stored air turned to poison. Better that we all go together. He recognized the sound that most of the rubble made upon the hull, bubble stone striking more bubble stone. Could it all have come from the pride of Lausanne? Impossible. There was far too much. Leinenscher. The doomed dome must have imploded, or exploded, or simply come apart without the stabilizing pressure of the depths. Then, with all its air lost and rushing skyward, the rest would plummet. Shards of bubble wall, dirt, pinions glowing feebly as they drifted ever lower. And people. That was the detritus Jonah most hoped to avoid. There, it looks jet black over there. The faithful old sub had almost finished its turn. Soon he might slack off, setting the boat upright. Once clear of the debris field, he could check on the passengers, then go back to seeking the home canyon. He never saw whatever struck next, but it had to be big, perhaps a major chunk of Leininger's wall. The blow hammered all three compartments in succession, ringing them like great gongs, making Jonah cry out in pain. There were other sounds, like ripping, tearing. The impact, somewhere below and toward portside, lifted him off his feet, tearing one of the rudder straps out of Jonah's hand, leaving him to swing wildly by the other. Bird sawed hard to the left as Jonah clawed desperately to reclaim the controls. At any moment, he expected to greet the harsh, cold sea and have his vessel join the skyfall of lost hopes. 6. Only gradually did it dawn on him. It wasn't over. The peril and problems, he wasn't about to escape them that easily. Yes, damage was evident, but the hulls, three ancient volcanic globes, still held. In fact, some while after that horrible collision, it did seem that Bird of Tyree had drifted clear of the heavy stuff. Material still rained upon the sub, but evidently softer materials, like still-glowing chunks of pinion vine. Petrie took charge of the rear compartments, crisply commanding passengers to help one another dig out and assessing their hurts in order of priority. She shouted reports to Jonah, whose hands were full. In truth, he had trouble hearing what she said over the ringing in his ears and had to ask for repetition several times. The crux? One teenager had a fractured wrist, while others bore bruises and contusions, a luckier toll than he expected. Bema, the Sedulite mother, kept busy delivering first aid. More worrisome was a leak. Very narrow, but powerful. A needle jet spewed water into the rear compartment. Not through a crack in the shell, fortunately, but via the packing material that surrounded the propeller bearing. Jonah would have to go back and have a look, but first he assessed other troubles. For example, the sub wouldn't right herself completely. There was a constant tilt to starboard around the roll axis. Then he checked the pressure gauge and muttered a low invocation to ancient gods and demons of old Earth. "We've stopped falling," he confided to Petrie in the stern compartment, once the leak seemed under control. It had taken some time, showing the others how to jam rubbery cloths into the bearing, then bracing it all with planks of wood torn from the floor. The arrangement was holding for now. "How can that be?" she asked. "We were heavy when the Pride let us go. I thought our problem was how to slow our descent." "It was, till our collision with whatever hit us. Based on where it struck along the portside keel, I'd guess that it knocked off some of our static ballast, the stones lashed to our bottom. The same thing that happened to Pride during that awful thumpquake. Other stones may have been dislodged or had just one of their lashings cut, leaving them to dangle below the starboard side and making us tilt like this. From these two examples, I'd say we've just learned a lesson today about a really bad flaw in the whole way we've done sub-design." "So, which is it? Are we rising?" Jonah nodded. "Slowly. It's not too bad yet, and I suppose it's possible we might resume our descent if we fill all the ballast tanks completely. Only, there's a problem." "Isn't there always?" Petrie rolled her eyes, clearly exasperated. "Yeah." He gestured toward where Zirish, by luck, a carpenter, was hammering more bracing into place. Jonah lowered his voice. "If we drop back to the seafloor, that bearing may not hold against full-bottom pressure.
it's likely to start spewing again, probably faster.
If it does, how long will we have?
Jonah frowned. Hard to say. Air pressure would fight back, of course. Still, I'd say less than an hour. Maybe not that much. We would have to spot one of the canyon domes right away, steer right for it, and plop ourselves into dock as fast as possible with everyone cranking like mad.
Only using the propeller will put even more stress on the bearing, Petri concluded with a thoughtful frown. It might blow completely.
Jonah couldn't prevent a brief smile.
Brave enough to face facts and a mechanical aptitude as well? I could find this woman attractive.
Well, I'm sure we can work something out, she added. You haven't let us down yet.
Not yet, he thought, and returned to work, feeling trapped by her confidence in him,
and cornered by the laws of chemistry and physics, as well as he understood them with his rudimentary education, taken from ancient books that were already obsolete when the founders first came to Venus, cowering away from alien invaders under a newborn ocean, while comets poured in with perfect regularity. Perfect for many lifetimes, but not forever. Not anymore. Even if we make it home, then go ahead with the Melville plan and manage to find another bubble-filled canyon less affected by the rogue thumps, how long will that last? Wasn't this whole project, colonizing the bottom of an alien sea with crude technology, always doomed from the start? In the middle compartment, Jonah opened his personal chest and took out some treasures. Books and charts that he had personally copied under supervision by Scholar Wu onto bundles of hand-scraped pinyon leaves. In one, he verified his recollection of Boyle's Law and the dangers of changing air pressure on the human body. From another, he got a formula that, he hoped, might predict how the leaky propeller shaft bearing would behave if they descended the rest of the way. Meanwhile, Petri put a couple of the larger teen girls to work on a bilge pump, transferring water from the floor of the third compartment into some almost full ballast tanks. Over the next hour, Jonah kept glancing at the pressure gauge. The truck appeared to be leveling off again.
Up and down, up and down. This can't be good for my old bird.
Leveled, stable, for now. That meant the onus fell on him with no excuse. To descend and risk the leak becoming a torrent, blasting those who worked the propeller crank, or else... Two hands laid pressure on his shoulders and squeezed inward, surrounding his neck, forcefully. Slim hands kneading tense muscles and tendons. Jonah closed his eyes, not wanting to divulge what he had decided.
Some wedding day, huh?
Jonah nodded. No verbal response seemed needed. He felt married for years, and glad of the illusion. Evidently, Petri knew him now, as well.
I bet you figured out what to do.
He nodded again.
And it won't be fun, or offer good odds of success.
A head shake, left, then right. Her hands dug in, reeking a mixture of pleasure and pain, like life. Then tell me, husband, she commanded. Then came around to bring their faces close. Tell me what you'll have us do. Which way do we go? He exhaled a sigh, then inhaled, and, finally, spoke one word. Up. 7. Toward the deadly sky, toward Venusian hell. It had to be. No other choice was possible. If we rise to the surface, I can try to repair the bearing from inside without water gushing through. And if it requires outside work, then I can do that by putting on a helmet and coveralls. Perhaps they'll keep out the poisons long enough. Petri shuddered at the thought.
Let us hope that won't be necessary.
Yeah. Though while I'm there, I could also fix the ballast straps holding some of the weight stones to our keel. I just don't see any other way. Petri sat on a crate opposite Jonah, mulling it over.
Wasn't upward motion what destroyed Leininger Colony and the Pride?
Yes, but their ascent was uncontrolled, rapid and chaotic. We'll rise slowly, reducing cabin air pressure in pace with the decreased push of water outside.
We have to go slow anyway, or the gas that's dissolved in our blood will boil and kill us. Slow and gentle, that's the way. She smiled. You know all the right things to say to a virgin.
Jonah felt his face go red. He was relieved when Petri got serious again.
If we rise slowly, won't there be another problem? Won't we run out of breathable air? He nodded. Activity must be kept to a minimum. Recycle and shift stale air into bottles, exchanging with the good air they now contain. Also, I have a spark separator.
You do? Aren't they rare and expensive?
I made this one myself.
Well, Panalina showed me how to use pinion crystals and electric current to split seawater into hydrogen and oxygen. We'll put some passengers to work, taking turns at the spin generator. And he warned her, it's a small unit. It may not produce enough.
Well, no sense putting things off then, Petri said with a grandmother's tone of decisiveness. Give your orders, man.
The ascent was grueling. Adults and larger teens took turns at the pumps expelling enough ballast water for the sub to start rising at a good pace, then correcting when it seemed too quick. Jonah kept close track of gauges revealing compression both inside and beyond the shells. He also watched for symptoms of decompression sickness, another factor keeping things slow. All passengers not on shift were encouraged to sleep, difficult enough when the youngest children kept crying over the pain in their ears. Jonah taught them all how to yawn or pinch their noses to equalize pressure, though his explanations kept being punctuated by fits of sneezing. Above all, even while resting, they all had to breathe deep as their lungs gradually purged and expelled excess gas from their bloodstreams. Meanwhile, the forechamber resonated with a constant background whine as older kids took turns at the spark separator, turning its crank so that small amounts of seawater divided into component elements, one of them breathable. The device had to be working, a layer of salt gathered in the brine collector. Still, Jonah worried, did I attach the poles right? Might I be filling the storage bottle with oxygen and letting hydrogen into the cabin? Filling the sub with an explosive mix that could put us out of our misery at any second? He wasn't sure how to tell. None of his books said, though he recalled vaguely that hydrogen had no odor. After following him on his rounds, inspecting everything and repeating his explanations several times, Petri felt confident enough to insist, "You must rest now, Jonah. I will continue to monitor our rate of ascent and make minor adjustments. Right now, I want you to close your eyes." When he tried to protest, she insisted, with a little more of the accented tone used by Losan mothers. "We will need you far more in a while. You'll require all your powers near the end, so lie down and recharge yourself. I promise to call if anything much changes." Accepting her reasoning, he obeyed by curling up on a couple of grain sacks that Zirish brought forward to the control cabin. Jonah's eyelids shut gratefully. The brain, however, was another matter. How deep are we now? It prompted an even bigger question. How deep is the bottom of Cleopatra Canyon nowadays? According to lore, the first colonists used to care a lot about measuring the thickness of Venusian seas, back when some surface light used to penetrate all the way to the ocean floor. They would launch balloons attached to huge coils of string in order to both judge depth and sample beyond the thermocline barrier and even from the hot, deadly sky. Those practices died out, though Jonah had seen one of the giant capstan reels once during a visit to Chowndome, gathering dust and moldering in a swampy corner. The way Earth denizens viewed their planet's hellish interior, that was how Cleo dwellers thought of the realm above, though there had been exceptions. Rumors held that Melville, that legendary rascal, upon returning from his discovery of Theodora Canyon, had demanded support to start exploring the Great Heights, possibly even the barrier zone, where living things thronged and might be caught for food. Of course, he was quite mad, though boys still whispered about him in hushed tones. How many comets? Jonah found himself wondering. Only one book in Tyree spoke of the Great Venus Terraforming Project that predated the Koss invasion. Mighty robots, as patient as gods, gathered ice balls at the farthest fringe of the solar system and sent them plummeting from that unimaginably distant realm to strike this planet, several each day, always at the same angle and position, both speeding the world's rotation and drenching its long-parched basins.
If each comet was several kilometers in diameter, how thick an ocean might spread across an entire globe in 20 generations of grandmothers? For every one that struck, 5 others were aimed to skim close by, tearing through the dense, clotted atmosphere of Venus, dragging some of it away before plunging to the sun. The scale of such an enterprise was stunning, beyond belief, so much so that Jonah truly doubted he could be of the same species that did such things. Petri, maybe. She could be that smart. Not me. How were such a people ever conquered? The royal of his drifting mind moved onward to might have been's, if not for that misguided comet, striking 6 hours late to wreak havoc near the canyon colonies. Jonah and his bride would by now have settled into a small, Losan cottage, getting to know each other in more traditional ways. Despite, or perhaps because of the emergency, he actually felt far more the husband of a vividly real person than he would have in that other reality where physical intimacy might have happened. Still, the lumpy grain sacks made part of him yearn for her in ways that, now, might never come to pass. That world would have been better, one where the pinyon vines waved their bright leaves gently overhead, where he might show her tricks of climbing vines, then swing from branch to branch, carrying her in his arms while the wind of flying passage ruffled their hair. A twang sound vibrated the cabin, like some mighty cord coming apart. The sub throbbed and Jonah felt it roll a bit. His eyes opened and he realized, I was asleep. Moreover, his head now rested on Petri's lap. Her hand had been the breeze in his hair. Jonah sat up. What was that? I do not know. There was a sharp sound. The ship hummed a bit, and now the floor no longer tilts. No longer. Jumping up with a shout, he hurried over to the gauges, then cursed low and harsh. What is it, Jonah? Quick, wake all the adults and get them to work pumping. She wasted no time demanding answers, but as soon as crews were hard at work, Petri approached Jonah again at the control station, one eyebrow raised. The remaining stone ballast, he explained. It must have been hanging by a thread or a single lashing. Now it's completely gone. The sub's tilt is corrected, but we're ascending too fast. Petri glanced at 2 Sedulites and 2 Losanites who were laboring to refill the ballast tanks. Is there anything else we can do to slow down? Jonah shrugged. I suppose we might unpack the leaky bearing and let more water into the aft compartment, but we'd have no control. The stream could explode in our faces. We might flood or lose the chamber. All told, I'd rather risk decompression sickness. She nodded, agreeing silently. They took their own turn at the pumps, then supervised another crew until, at last, the tanks were full. Bird could get no heavier, not without flooding the compartments themselves. We have to lose internal pressure. That means venting air overboard, he said, in order to equalize. But we'll need it to breathe. There's no choice. With our tanks full of water, there's no place to put extra air and still reduce pressure. So, different pumps and valves, but more strenuous work. Meanwhile, Jonah kept peering at folks in the dim illumination of just 2 faint glow bulbs, watching for signs of the bends. Dizziness, muscle aches, and labored breathing, these could just be the result of hard labor. The book said to watch out also for joint pain, rashes, delirium, or sudden unconsciousness. He did know that the old dive tables were useless based on Earth-type humanity. And we've changed. First, because our scientist ancestors modified themselves and their offspring. But time, too, has altered what we are, even long after we lost those wizard powers. Each generation was an experiment. Has it made us less vulnerable to such things, or more so? Someone tugged his arm. It wasn't Petri striving at her pump. Jonah looked down at one of the children, still wearing a stained and crumpled bridesmaid's dress, who pulled shyly, urging Jonah to come follow. At first he thought, it must be the sickness. She's summoning me to help someone's agony, but what can I do? Only it wasn't toward the stern that she led him, but the forwardmost part of the ship, to the view patch where she pointed. What is it? Pressing close to the curved pane, Jonah tensed as he starkly envisioned some new cloud of debris, till he looked up and saw light. Vague, at first, only a child's perfect vision would have noticed it so early, but soon it spread and brightened across the entire vault overhead. I thought we would pass through the thermocline. He had expected a rough, perhaps even lethal, transition past that supposed barrier between upper and lower oceans, but it must have happened gently while he slept. Jonah called someone to relieve Petrie and brought her forth to see. "Go back and tell people to hold on tight," Petrie dispatched the little girl. Then she turned to grab Jonah's waist as he took the control straps. At this rate, they appeared to be seconds away from entering Venusian hell. Surely it has changed, he thought, nursing a hope that had never been voiced even in his mind. The ocean has burgeoned as life fills the seas. Already he spied signs of movement above. Flitting, flickering shapes, living versions of the crushed and dead specimens that sometimes fell to Tyree's bottom realm, now undulating and darting about what looked like scattered patches of dense, dangling weed. He steered to avoid those. If the sea has changed, then might not the sky, the air, even the highlands? Charts of Venus, radar mapped by ancient Earthling space probes, revealed vast continents and basins, a topography labeled with names like Aphrodite Terra and Lakshmi Planum. Every single appellation was that of a female from history or literature or legend. Well, that seemed fair enough. But had it been a cruel joke to call the baked and bone-dry lowlands seas? Till humanity decided to make old dreams come true. What will we find? To his and Petrie's awestruck eyes, the dense crowd of life revealed glimpses, shapes like dragons, like fish, or those ancient blimps that once cruised the skies of ancient Earth, and something within Jonah allowed itself to hope. Assuming we survived decompression, might the fiery, sulfurous air now be breathable? Perhaps, barely as promised by the sagas? By now, could life have taken to high ground? Seeded in some clever century's delay by those same pre-cost designers? His mind pictured scenes from a few dog-eared storybooks, only enormously expanded and brightened. Vast, measureless jungles, drenched by rainstorms, echoing with the bellows of gigantic beasts. A realm so huge, so rich, and densely forested that a branch of humanity might thrive, grow, prosper, and learn, regaining might and confidence beneath that sheltering canopy, safe from invader eyes. That, once upon a time, had been the dream, though few imagined it might fully come to pass. Jonah tugged the tiller to avoid a looming patch of dangling vegetation. Then, ahead and above, the skyward shallows suddenly brightened, so fiercely that he and Petrie had to shade their eyes, inhaling and exhaling heavy gasps. They both cried out as a great slithering shape swerved barely out of the sub's way. Then, brilliance filled the cabin like a blast of molten fire. I was wrong to hope. It truly is hell. A roar of foamy separation, and for long instants, Jonah felt free of all weight. He let go of the straps and clutched Petrie tight, twisting to put his body between hers and the wall as their vessel flew over the sea, turned slightly, then dropped back down, striking the surface with a shuddering blow and towering splash. Lying crumpled below the viewing patch, they panted, as did everyone else aboard, groaning and groping themselves to check for injuries, for reassurance of life. And gradually, the hellish brightness seemed to abate till Jonah realized, it is my eyes, adapting. They never saw daylight before. Jonah and Petrie helped each other stand. Together they turned, still shading their eyes. Sound had transformed, and so had the very texture of the air, now filled with strange aromas. There must be a breach. With shock, still blinking away glare-wrought tears, Jonah saw the cause. Impact must have knocked loose the dog bolts charged with holding shut the main hatch amidships on the starboard side, never meant to open anywhere but at the safety of a colonial dock. With a shout, he hurried over, even knowing it was too late. The poisons of Venus apparently weren't here. No one keeled over. His body's sole reaction to the inrushing atmosphere was to sneeze, a report so loud and deep that it rocked him back. Jonah reached the hatch and tried pushing it closed, but Bird of Tyree was slightly tilted to port. The heavy door overwhelmed Jonah's resistance and kept gradually opening, from crack to slit to gap to chasm. "I'll help you, Jonah," came an offer so low, like a rich male baritone, yet recognizably that of his wife. He turned, saw her eyes wide with surprise at her own voice. "The air, it contains," his words emerged now a deep bass, "different gases than we got from pinions."
Different, but breathable, even pleasant.
Blinking a couple of times, he managed to shrug off the shock of his new voice and tried once more to close the hatch before giving up for now. With the boat's slight leftward roll, there was no immediate danger of flooding, as seawater lapped a meter or so below. The opening must be closed soon, of course. But not quite yet. For, as Jonah and Petrie stood at the sill, what confronted them was more than vast rippling blue ocean and a cloud-dense firmament. Something else lay between those two, just ahead and to starboard, a thick mass of shimmery greens and browns that filled the horizon, receding in mist toward distant serrated skylines. Though he never dreamed of witnessing such a thing firsthand, they both recognized the sight from ancient, faded pictures. Land, shore, everything. And overhead, creatures flapped strange, graceful wings, or drifted like floating jellyfish above leafy spires.
"It will take some time to figure out what we can eat," his wife commented with feminine practicality.
Jonah replied, too caught up in wonder to say more, a silence that lasted for many poundings of his heart, until, finally, he managed to add,
"Someday, we must go back down and tell."
After another long pause, Petrie answered, "Yes, someday." She held him tight around the chest, a forceful constriction that only filled Jonah with strength. His lungs expanded as he inhaled deeply a sweet smell and knew that only part of that was her.
Garth Nix. Here's an ex-soldier who's dragooned into joining an expedition attempting to penetrate the deepest, most deadly, and most impenetrable part of the Venusian swamps, and who finds that he must go native in the most profound and fundamental of ways if he's to have any chance to survive. New York Times best-selling Australian writer Garth Nix worked as a book publicist, editor, marketing consultant, public relations man, and literary agent before launching the best-selling Old Kingdom series, which consists of Sabriel, Lyriel, Daughter of the Clare, Abhorson, and The Creature in the Case. His other books include the Seventh Tower series, consisting of The Fall, Castle, Aenir, Above the Veil, Into Battle, and The Violet Keystone. The Keys to the Kingdom series, consisting of Mr. Monday, Grim Tuesday, Drowned Wednesday, Sir Thursday, Lady Friday, Superior Saturday, and Lord Sunday, as well as standalone novels such as The Rag Witch and Shade's Children. His short fiction has been collected in Across the Wall, A Tale of the Abhorson and Other Stories. His most recent books are two novels written with Sean Williams, Trouble Twisters, The Mystery, and Trouble Twisters, The Monster, a new standalone novel, A Confusion of Princes, and a new collection, Sir Hereward and Master Fitz, Three Adventures. Born in Melbourne, he now lives in Sydney, Australia.
By Frog Sled and Lizardback to Outcast Venusian Lepers. By Garth Nix. Read for you by Harry Lloyd. The martini glass in its special bracket near Kelvin's left hand shivered as the shuttle's wheels touched the Plascrete runway. For a moment, it looked like the blood orange, gin, and vermouth mixture would splash over the side before it settled down as the shuttle eased into its long, whining run down Venusport's shortest, cheapest, and busiest landing strip. "Didn't spill," said Kelvin. Without taking his eyes off the strip ahead or his right hand from the control yoke, he reached over and picked up the martini to take a delicate sip. "That's $2.50 you owe me now." "I'll be checking the black box vid," said a disembodied woman's voice through the cockpit speakers. "Besides, it could still spill when we break." "Nope," said Kelvin. A holographic display had popped up in front of him, advising him to apply reverse thrust and wheel brakes, and several other pop-ups were flashing amber alerts about systems not working as expected, but they were the ones he expected, so that was okay. "Drinking it now. First touchdown, that's always the rule. Everyone okay back there, Suze?"
"Sure, I only had to stun 2 so far. Early starters on some kind of energizer. Quite a bit overexcited about the fabled Venusian attractions. Wanted to get out early, like at 10,000 meters.
"Miners," said Kelvin. He put the martini back and worked the controls, briefly applying himself to bringing the shuttle to a complete stop before immediately taxiing off the strip towards the terminal. There was another shuttle a minute and a half behind him, and 12 more in various stages of approach. The 6-month shift change from Mercury Incorporated was on. The leave ship, a converted megaliner, was in orbit, and 10,000 miners who couldn't afford to get all the way back to Earth were raring to come down to sample the delights and diversions of the excessively humid, permanently cloud-shrouded city of Venusport and its surrounds.
"Venusport, Venusport," said Kelvin. "Drop Baker 17, rolling into gate 25, looking for a fast turnaround. What's my slot in the catapult?"
There was no immediate answer, which was unusual. Shuttle traffic was controlled by an expert system with a voice synthesizer some joker had tweaked to make it sound like an old Venus hand with lung husk problems. It usually snapped back immediately, wasting no time.
"Venusport, Venusport, I say again, this is Drop Baker. Drop Baker 17, meet gate, pilot in charge, stand by for further instructions."
"Stand by?" asked Kelvin. He recognized the voice of Chief Controller Candice, who was very rarely to be found in the tower. Venusport traffic was easygoing, with few rules about anything other than safety, and the expert systems ran that well enough. "You kidding me, Candice? I got to pay for this crate, you know. I can't be sitting on the ground when there are miners to move."
"Stand by for orders, Cal," said Candice wearily. "Terran Navy will meet you at the gate."
"What? Navy? To meet me? Why?"
"Don't ask me. Now leave me alone. I'm busy today."
"You done something bad?" asked Suze over the in-system.
"Well, nothing that would involve the Terran Navy," said Kelvin, mystified.
Venusport was a treaty city, administered by a complicated tripartite council from the Terran World Government, which wasn't really the whole world as it excluded several pariah states, MBU, Mars and Beyond United, not including Ceres, and Mercury Incorporated, corporate dictatorship at its best. In practice, local interests dominated Venusport, and everything was pretty freewheeling, unless something major came up and one of the interplanetary governments decided to shove their oar in.
"I think."
"Well, sort it out, quick," said Suze. Kelvin owned 63.7% of the shuttle Light-Heeled Loafer, but the rest was held by Suze's family on Venus Above, the orbital station. Suze was aboard to protect their interests as much as manage passengers and cargo, and her many clone brothers and sisters handled all the back-end office and engineering tasks.
I will, vowed Kelvin.
He handed over to the robot docker, fingers running through the shutdown sequence, even as his mind wandered over years of sometimes shady dealings and borderline illegal activities. He could think of plenty of reasons why the usually somnolent Venusport Customs Service might want to talk to him with the aim of extracting further payola, but he couldn't think of anything he'd done recently that would get the Terran Navy on his back. Despite not being able to come up with anything specific, Kelvin still had a niggling feeling of disquiet. He kept thinking about it as he knocked back his antifungal booster tablets with the last of the martini, unstrapped and got out of his seat, unsealed his helmet and racked it, smeared some antifungal cream on his face and hands, then put on his planet-side belt with holstered heat beam, for Venusian ambulatory fungus and the like, Stunner for ambulatory human lowlifes and the like, and Bushknife for when the options got really limited. He eyed the bar at the back of the cockpit for a moment, considering a second martini, but decided against it. Time enough for that when the loafer was back in orbit. "Cabin secure?" he asked Suze. Though as always, he also checked the somewhat mildewed viewscreen next to the hatch. Miners were exiting to the gate in an orderly fashion, doubtless encouraged by the sight of Suze, huge in her armoured vacuum suit, a stunner held tight in her right gauntlet, her left hand entirely encased in the ball of a field lightning projector, for those exciting moments when the occupants of the entire front six passenger rows needed to be shocked into better behaviour. "Yeah, all okay." Kelvin palmed the hatch, then repeated the gesture several times until it opened, letting in a wave of warm, moist air. Like everything else on the shuttle, the sensor was affected by too much moisture and by Venusian molds that had a liking for plastic. Only so much could be done with regular cleaning and decontamination. The life of even venerified tech was always much shorter than the manufacturers claimed. "Go and get whatever it is sorted out," said Suze. "I'll do the ground admin and clear us to go back up." "Thanks, Suze," said Kelvin. He smiled, trying not to show his apprehension. He hoped it would be both of them going back up. Suze could fly the shuttle if she had to, though she wasn't anywhere near as experienced as Kelvin, having learned on the job, whereas he had been through the full orbital atmosphere school at Fort Atherton, then flown 10 years operational with the Pan-Pacific Collective Combined Forces on Earth, before somehow living through the third PPCCF intervention, flying assault shuttles to and from the beachhead on Deimos to Mars. "Oh, shit," he said, as his previous vague apprehension solidified into a more certain dread. His Navy service was 20 years ago, and with a different Navy, but he was still getting a derisory pension, and there had been some small print attached to that when he demobbed.